Very few physicians remain in the same role or location for the entirety of their career. Therefore, career transitions are a normal part of any medical career. Dr. Aditya Bagrodi and I both changed institutions at similar times in our career and are both adjusting to new locations, new roles, and new people. In this podcast, we compare, contrast, and discuss considerations for surgeons as they transition from one job to another. We hope you enjoy. My name is Phil Perazio, and I'm a urologic oncologist, a surgeon. Like many of you, I absolutely love what I do, and I would not choose another profession. But I have struggled with professional identity, practice efficiency, and wellness over the years. Operate with Zen is a podcast designed to explore a mindful approach to surgery and to being a surgeon. By discussing these struggles and mindful solutions, I hope together we can create a community of strong and healthy surgeons. Enjoy. Welcome to Operate with Zen. Today, I've got the great pleasure of being visited by a good friend, Aditya Bagrodia. Dr. Bagrodia, introduce yourself to the crowd.
Hey, Phil. Thanks so much for having me on. Aditya Bagrodia. I am a urologic oncologist, most recently at UC San Diego. I've been here for about 5 months. Previously, I was at UT Southwestern as an assistant professor for 5 years, blink of an eye. And it's kind of crazy to sit back and reflect on transitions with you, Phil. And ironically, ours seem to perfectly coincide.
Yeah, excellent. So yeah, Aditya and I have been friends now for, geez, a decade or so through the testicular cancer realm and taking care of patients and working with patient advocacy organizations and even doing some podcasting together other than this episode on back table urology. But here we are today to talk about career transitions. And both of us had big career transitions right at the exact same time, different stories, different timings, but we're here to talk about it because people are either going to be going through transitions or going through them as we currently speak. So a lot to learn and a lot to kind of go over here. So why don't you tell us briefly your story and kind of where it started and where you are now in your transition?
Yeah, so certainly not something that I sought out, Phil. To be quite honest, I absolutely adore my department at UT Southwestern and am quite pleased to stay on as an adjunct professor to keep some of the research things going. But if there was a reason to move, it was going to be closer to family, hot off the heels of the pandemic, hadn't seen a lot of our family in a year and a half, and flights and all the logistics were getting a little bit challenging, and an opportunity arose. Actually, a mentor of mine from when I was a medical student who's currently at UC San Diego reached out and said, hey, we're looking for somebody to kind of spearhead the testis program. Would you be interested? And both my wife and myself have lots of family out here kind of in the Southern California area, which is the only reason it was even an opportunity or a possibility, honestly. So I feel like I was a little bit lucky in that I was sought out or approached in an area that made sense for me personally. You know, none of this was actually a professionally driven decision. It certainly wasn't a financially driven decision. It was really about getting close to family. Location was the big driver here.
Yeah, you bring in, it's a great story and a really fortunate story for you. You know, mine similar, but slightly different. Same kind of thing. I wasn't looking for a new job. I absolutely loved Hopkins and loved working at Hopkins. But actually, through the pandemic, two opportunities arose from two like-minded institutions on the East Coast here, and both offered great opportunities for professional development and kind of steps beyond what I was doing at Hopkins, basically to take all the stuff I was doing there, transition them to a new institution and build other people. And so for me, it was the opposite. It was a little bit of professional development, But on the flip side, having to move my family and trying to decide, you know, was it the right move, and how far was the correct move? And ultimately we decided that Philadelphia was the correct transition from Baltimore, which is not terribly far away, but certainly a little bit of transition. But it brings up a good point, and I think we can have kind of a little bit of a conversation here about, you know, why people may transition. And you brought up a couple of them: career development, family issues, financial interests. You know, what are some of your thoughts on, you know, good and bad reasons that people may, you know, have transitions?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there could be a push. You know, if you're at your institution and you're not happy, and you've reflected after some bit of time, and you ask yourself, is this really what I want to be doing? And definitely, I think we all know, many fold over now, that, you know, we kind of get one crack at this. And do you want to look back and say, I kind of didn't really enjoy going to work, I slugged through it? It's not easy to overcome that inertia and change, but certainly I think if you're not happy, that'd be one rationale. And then the other is, you know, you're looking for some change. You're looking for something different. Maybe you come off a strong background, but broadly, you could say lifestyle. Do I want to be in a different location? Do I want to be closer to family? You know, for us, an added benefit of being in San Diego is this ability to kind of embark on an outdoor based lifestyle. I took my first surf lesson yesterday. It was amazing.
Sounds amazing.
It was. It was a little cold, but it was still awesome. You know, then professional
get up.
Got up 6 times, probably drank about a gallon of water. But it was a lot of fun. And the kids got up too. Career advancement, you know, if there's an opportunity, you know, like yourself, to take a leadership position, take an administrative position, maybe get some more research time, a program director, who knows, you know, whatever it may be to you, that's important. So I think there's, you know, the professional part, there's the personal, maybe quality of life part. Then to me, the third aspect of it is finances. You know, are you able to kind of get where you need to be from a financial life goal perspective? So I think those are the ones, if you're looking for change, not because you're unhappy, maybe drivers. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think those are all, you know, things that we look to do in our professional lives, right? We want to have meaning in what we do. We want to progress professionally. And there's lots of ways to progress with and without new titles or leadership roles, right? For you, you're taking your lab and building out your lab and bringing something to a new institution. Here, I'm bringing things to a new institution and really have a focus on building junior faculty and building other people around me, which has gotten really exciting to me over the last few years. So it was those new opportunities. And that's going to be a highly individualized question, is what is that opportunity for you?
Absolutely. I mean, we both come from, you know, extremely well-established programs where you've worked hard actually over the course of your residency and attendinghood to develop a reputation. You're kind of a known commodity. And then you leave all of that for something new and nobody knows who you are. I mean, I remember my first couple of times I'm in the OR lounge and I'm like, this is such a trip. I don't know anybody and nobody knows me. And it's a wild thing to kind of go through that. And it's humbling, actually, is what I've found.
Super humbling. but also super exciting to meet new people and kind of reboot your identity. And listen, we all did things wrong in the beginning of our careers that we wish we could do better. And we kind of get a second chance to make a first impression with a whole new crew of people.
Yeah, fair. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You brought it up a little bit before, finances, and without getting into specific details, we don't want to know details of contracts or anything like that, but how did you think about the finances when you transitioned from Texas to California? And I'll give you my story too.
Yeah. So I was actually up for and received my promotion from assistant to associate, you know, as my fifth year in Dallas. And I did get a sense of, you know, what that would look like in terms of salary at UT Southwestern. Then basically I did some research on cost adjustment from Dallas to San Diego. And, you know, there's pretty good data out there. I think it wound up as like a 23% increase cost of living. And, you know, our salaries in Dallas, I think we're very fair. You know, this is all kind of published available data for an assistant professor, an associate professor, a full professor, that these are your, you know, interquartile ranks, et cetera. So I knew I had a fair salary. I did a cost of living adjustment. I proposed that to Manoj Manga, who's the chair here at UC San Diego, and he accepted. And, you know, I didn't go back and forth. When I talked to Klaus Rohrbern, who's, you know, a dear friend, mentor, and the chairman in Dallas, I said, Klaus, I have to talk to you because I've made a decision and I'm going to leave. This wasn't a negotiation. And, you know, maybe we'll get there, but I also think it's worth mentioning, at the first time point that anybody from San Diego reached out, I talked to Klaus, who's the chair of the department, and I talked to Yair Lotan, who was the chief of oncology. It felt like the right thing to do. B, I think being transparent just took a lot of the anxiety. You know, it's an exciting process, but you feel a little bit weird, a little bit disloyal, perhaps. But the best thing I did was just to kind of let them know from time point zero, for a variety of reasons, including the fact that at least academic medicine, and at least in your little subspecialty, the world is so small that, you know, nobody wants to hear that things are going on and they're, you know, totally blindsided.
Yeah, I think those are great points. Yeah, I did the financial calculations as well. You know, Philly's about, depending on where you look, a 10 to 20% increased cost of living compared to Baltimore. Although I'll tell you, in the housing market, it's a little different than that. But that's, I think, one of the first comparisons you have to do. I mean, we just kind of looked up and down the East Coast at the numbers. Baltimore to New York was a 50% increase in cost of living. I mean, that's brutal. Insane. And when you think about what that salary negotiation comes on the back end, you've got to be able to cover not only your new cost of living, but, you know, when my wife and I were having the home negotiations of, is this worth move it? We had to be better off financially than we were in Baltimore. So that meant we had to have income that we could either invest or get us closer to retirement or a retirement home or whatever it was. So that was one of the criteria my wife and I used at home. And I thought that was very helpful when we got to negotiations, was not only does it have to be equal, but it's got to be a better move for us because we're not unhappy in Baltimore. And I thought that was a really important part of our internal negotiations. And then you're absolutely right about, you got to let your bosses know. And the question is, when do you let them know? Similarly, so I actually came up to, I'm at University of Pennsylvania now. When I did the first interview day here, in all honesty, and the people of Pennsylvania know this, I wasn't necessarily incredibly optimistic about the job, but I said I would do the interviews and kind of scope it out because it was a good opportunity. And I was completely blown away on the first day of interviews. The next day, woke up, went directly to Alan Parton's office, who was my chair at Hopkins, and said, we need to talk. And I was just like you, fully transparent, totally honest. I wasn't really looking. They called with an opportunity. It sounds like something really interesting, and I want to explore it further with your blessing. And as a good boss does, he said, yeah, please explore it and let me know along the way how it's going. And, you know, if you need help making a decision or how we work through this. So, you know, I'm sure there are less gracious bosses out there, but I think we both had good responses from our leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those things, again, that in any profession, this happens like a very, very frequently over the course of one's career. For us, I don't think you're a bad person. I don't think you're disloyal. You know, it's actually a really, if you're sought out, it's a very nice recognition of whatever you've been doing, I suppose. And if you seek somebody out and they're interested, you know, same general deal. You know, I recognize that it can be different, right? If you've got a unhappy relationship or if the environment's not good, then that could make that conversation a little bit, you know, it's personal. But I think globally, if you've got somebody that's at least aware, it's probably preferable. The last thing before we kind of move on is, I think it's worth having like a deal breaker and a deal maker salary in your head. That, you know, we really don't think that we can live the type of life we want below X. And, you know, if we get to here, you know, this could really be an opportunity to do things from a, you know, financial perspective that's useful. Because otherwise, you have these what ifs, right? Did I leave money on the table? Could I have gotten more? Blah, blah, blah. And it just goes on and on. But, you know, going back to some of your more philosophical things in the podcast is, what do I think that I need to be happy and comfortable? And then kind of take that off of your plate.
Yeah, no, and that's absolutely true. And, you know, I joke, you know, Sarah and I are not Maserati people. We drive very, you know, humble cars, but we like to travel and we like to go places with our kids and we want to retire before the time we're 80. So those were important things to us. And you're absolutely right. I had the internal conversation where I said, all right, here's the number that would make moving possible. And here's the number that she can't refuse. Right. If that number comes, then my wife can't refuse it. And it makes us a better off as a family and as a couple. So yeah, really, really, really good points. I wanted to stay on the boss topic. And, you know, there's the initial kind of disclosure of, hey, I'm looking, hey, I'm talking. And then it comes down to contract time and negotiations and retention and other things come up. So tell me kind of your insights on that process. And was it the same open disclosure and transparency? I'll tell you right off the bat, mine wasn't, but you know, let me know how your kind of process played out.
Yeah. So I, for better or for worse, didn't engage a lot of people in that conversation. I wasn't honestly crystal clear on what the kind of I had an idea. Actually, I did talk to the chair here about the ranges of salaries for the staff at San Diego. And, you know, I had a sense of the ranges of the salaries of staff at UT Southwestern. And I certainly don't think that the way I did it was the only way. You know, my calculation was, here's what my associate professor level was going to be. Let me adjust that for the cost of living. Maybe tag on a little bonus, just like you said, to make it, you know, not only equivalent, but, you know, better, I suppose, and go from there. But actually, to be quite honest, I think that my transition precipitated kind of a overhaul of the entire salary structure at UT Southwestern. And I don't think it was a malicious thing in any way, shape, or fashion. I think it was just a opportunity to see what's going on in other parts of the world. I mean, you know, without going down this rabbit hole too far, you get hired at a salary, then at some, you know, you turn into an associate professor and that goes up, and then you go to a full professor and that goes up. And those are kind of your opportunities to increase. Perhaps you have an annual or a biannual meeting with your chair and you say, hey, can I do this? Or are there some stipends because now I'm doing this, blah, blah, blah. But somebody that was hired 20 years ago may be kind of at a slightly lower just bar, you know, cost of living, et cetera, than somebody that was hired 6 months ago. And obviously, fundamentally, there's something not ideal about that. So I think people that asked me candidly, and I was pretty happy to share, you know, what my information is, they looked at it and said, hey, you know, is there an opportunity to negotiate here? And I didn't do it because, you know, again, this wasn't really a professional or financial thing, but I don't know, you know, and I also knew that I was leaving and I had my kind of deal maker number. So I didn't want to get something from Klaus and then go to Manoj, but I don't think that's unreasonable in the same breath.
Yeah, no, great points. You know, I didn't go back to my leadership until I had a contract in hand. And the reason I didn't is because I didn't want to create anxieties or get people worked up if it wasn't going to progress that far with you know, the new job opportunity with Pennsylvania. And so when I had a contract offer and I had gone back and forth with Penn to a place that I was happy, I went to our leadership and said, hey, listen, this is what they're offering. And I thought very appropriately said, okay, well, you know, give us some time. Let's see, you know, give us the contract if you don't mind, or the bare bones of it, and tell us what else you would need to stay at Hopkins and let's see what we could do. And I thought that was very fair because like you, I wasn't unhappy in Baltimore. I was very happy in Baltimore, but this was a new opportunity. And so I absolutely wanted to give them the opportunity to match. And I mean, long story short, through no fault of anyone's, they didn't. And so the offer at Penn became that much more appealing.
Yeah, I think that's if you're not sold that you're going to leave and you're still kind of balancing this professional financial quality of life trifecta, and one of them can tip the scales to stay, makes total sense. And after the initial disclosure, and I kind of kept our chairman and leadership abreast, but when I got the contract in hand, I got it like Friday night, Pacific time. So when I woke up, it was in my email, and I called my chair, and we met in person that day. And it was a amazing, intense, emotional conversation about I'm leaving and this is why it's so hard. But I think what you did is, if it wasn't a foregone conclusion that you're leaving, the smart thing to do, 100%.
Yeah, and you see too, I'm sure you've seen it at the variety of institutions you've been at, where people kind of threaten to leave all of the time. And there's always rumors of this job offer, or that job offer, and this contract and that contract. And you see those kind of, you see that potentially acting negatively on people. It can kind of ruin their, or hinder their progression in an institution for leadership. It can affect their relationships, certainly. And it just kind of can create animosity, in my opinion, where it doesn't need to exist. I don't know if you've seen that or encountered that. I'm sure you have.
Yeah. I mean, I think there can be the person who cried wolf phenomenon that, they're never going to leave because they're both sides of the family and they've been there for 1,000 years. Then you have people that, again, appropriately advocate for yourself. I felt that in Dallas, particularly, having been there from a researcher to a resident, I was like, this is just a ridiculous cast of faculty, and Peggy Pearl and Jeff Kadedu and Al Morey, and it just goes on and on and on. And, there's Gary Lamack, it never ends. And they were approached to be chair people here or there. And, Klaus did a tremendous job retaining them. And I think they stayed and they're happy because it was such a wonderful place. And this is a crazy thing. I think I'm the first person to leave UT Southwestern. It's a nutty thing for even me to wrap my brain around. And when I talked to Klaus, and I told him, and he knew it. I mean, it was intense. It was emotional. I mean, it was like a big gooey mess. He was like, Aditya, people have come to me and they've asked for time, for money, for title, for position. And you're coming to me to tell me that you want to be closer to family. I can never fault you for that. I moved here as a German immigrant. I know what it's like to not be close to my family all the time. And you're doing what you need to do. I think it can. I also think advocating for yourself is okay, as long as it's done appropriately, transparently, and not with ridiculous demands that you think that you're in some way, shape, or fashion better than everybody else.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. So just to think about some of the other things that people may negotiate for. So obviously you have a lab, not everybody has a lab, but what are some of the other things that went into your negotiation or thought process when leaving, just so other people out there can kind of think of the things that you may not think of when you're thinking about moving?
Yeah. I mean, I think time and money, at least for academics, and whether you have a lab or you want to start up a clinical trials program or you want to start up a biobank, who knows what. It takes time and it takes money. Unfortunately, I think largely due to cost of living in San Diego, many people in my lab weren't able to move. And I totally get it. Some of it was situational, family ties, multiple children, et cetera. But you need to be able to hire people. You need to be able to outfit a lab. I think having a mentor in this is massively critical. I have, people on the lab side that I really reach out to and trust. And it's like, what kind of numbers do I need to look at here, you know, startup costs, outfitting a lab, hiring somebody, you know, looking at the directs and the indirects, what does that look like annually? And then coming up with something that I think gives you a decent cushion to transition to independent funding. So for me, I asked for, you know, 4 years to be kind of covered, so that I could, you know, establish my biobank, hire the correct people, get things up and running. And, you know, I personally feel that if I can't kind of make it happen in 3 or 4 years, then, you know, the use of that funds probably needs to be reevaluated. And it, you know, so part of that's also going to depend on, you know, if you're a medical oncologist, MD, PhD, that's clinical 2 weeks a year, that's different from a physician scientist that's clinical, you know, 3 to 4 days a week. So for me, you know, time-wise, it was literally like you can have 1 day of research or you can have 2 days. But if you have 2 days, it's going to equal a $50,000 salary cut, which I think is okay. I don't think that's, you know, outlandish at all. And my thought was in the initial year, it's going to take some time to kind of ramp up and I'll have a little bit more discretionary time until, you know, the clinics get busy and the ORs get busy. And, you know, it didn't quite pan out that way, but things are still moving forward.
All right. Good. Yeah. I think, you know, you bring up some really good points. I mean, the bottom line is you need to negotiate for your own initial success. Right. And mm-hmm. for you, that's lab space, lab personnel. For me, it was a little bit more of a clinical transition. So, you know, building clinical programs here. So I needed personnel to help build clinical programs. And I think the biggest thing that I learned through this is aligning expectations for everyone. And some of that comes down to putting things on paper, right? What are your, whether it's RVUs or collections, there are going to be financial targets. What am I responsible for on an annual basis or however you break it down, semi-annual basis, so that I understand what you want me to achieve so that I can do the things I want to achieve. And that's where the negotiation comes in. And people forget sometimes in negotiations, it's not about you winning or them winning. It's about meeting in the middle somewhere, right? They're going to have things they want. And most institutions, for better or worse, are going to be financially driven, where we tend to be a little more kind of socially driven, right? We want to work on research. We want to work on academics. We want to work on the people around us. We want to promote the field. We want to do better science, whatever it may be. And so aligning those social and market expectations, I think, takes a little bit of work so that there are no unhappy customers 6 months, 1 year, 2 years into this. Everybody understands kind of where the playing field is.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I mean, I kind of reflect back on some of the things that we've done here at UC San Diego that were never kind of my responsibility, so to speak. But, you know, like we've established a bladder MRI program. We've started like a rad path for all of our ultrasound fusion biopsies. Just to make sure, you know, our diagnostics are tip top. We've actually started thinking about ramping up a HIFU program, and that's moving kind of along next level for our transperineal prostate program. And you're probably like thinking like, Aditya, is this really you? Like, you know, I'm doing a lot of stuff on prostate, and that's, you know, even my practice prior to this was 40-50% prostate. And it's important, I think, like as you're doing stuff, to also sit back and be like, these are things that I've done. Like nobody was like, hey, nice job. You put together a patient information packet for people receiving a prostatectomy. But I'm like, this is important. You know, if you get a prostatectomy, like how to do Kegels and, you know, what does it look like? And, you know, have some pictures and diagrams. So, you know, these are things we're trying to do to improve clinical quality, to make the patient experience better, to do all of these things. And it doesn't translate into dollar and cents, and it doesn't give you an easy checkbox of like, I accomplished this. So I think it's you're spot on, you know, by actually keeping tabs on what you've been up to and sharing that, you could say in a tactful way with relevant parties is important.
Yeah, no, and you're absolutely right. And on a selfish standpoint, right, taking the time to invest in whether it's patient education materials or clinical kind of excellence materials saves you on the back end, right? So So by taking the time up front to engage in materials that are going to save you from having to have the same conversation over and over again, or whatever the, you know, the analogous kind of story is, I think allows you to do the other things that you find interesting. So worthwhile investments, especially in the beginning of a transition.
Yeah, ERAS pathway implementation, all these things that, you know, like this has got to happen. You know, this is the environment that I want to practice in. And, you know, first things first, that's got to be, to me, it's one-on-one. It starts with patient care and the rest of it will take place. But we really want to, I think, make sure that we're in an environment that's, you know, kind of contemporary, top-notch clinical care. And, you know, the value of having people come in after some time at another place is you get perspective, new ideas.
Absolutely. So I am roughly 4 months into this new job. I think you're a little bit longer than I am, 5 months or so, maybe six. But tell me, you know, what you've learned, anything you would have done differently. I know it's a short term to reflect, but we all learn on things and go from there.
Yeah. So, you know, just one kind of word about the previous institution. I do think it's pretty much mandatory to give everybody on the previous side plenty of time to kind of get things sorted out. To me, maybe 4 to 6 months would be adequate to let patients know, to let the staff have a plan for your patients, you know, whether that's going to be your partners or APPs or, you know, whatever that kind of looks like. I think an abrupt leave is going to leave a totally sour taste in people's mouth. B, I think if you're transitioning, we've kind of talked about this a little bit before. It's a wonderful time to spend the time with your patients, let your patients know firsthand and remind yourself of all the positive impact that you've had on people's lives. Because, you know, many times I feel like it's the tough complications that really stick with us. And just kind of enjoy the process of transition. You know, it's so kind of, I felt like extremely anxiety provoking in a lot of ways. And I was like, what am I, I'm thinking about this new job. And I thought about my lab so much, you know, like I have an amazing research scientist, a postdoc and a tech. And I was like, oh my gosh, what are they going to do? And, you know, if you're a hardworking person, like all three of them are, there's wonderful opportunities. And actually my senior mentor, Jim Amatruda, who's a medical oncologist at Children's Hospital LA, was like, he's like, Aditya, they're amazing. They're going to be fine. And they're not your children. Which was a, you know, a little bit more blunt coming from a pediatric medical oncologist, but it was totally true. And they're all doing amazing. You know, one of them's on her way into med school. The other one just got hired by McKinsey, and the other one's, you know, launching a new career in computational biology. So I think, you know, a heads up is the first thing. Then I think it's really worth, you know, the first off, just kind of understanding what your new job is going to look like. Nuts and bolts, like how many days in the OR, how many days in the clinic, how many days time, admin, research, however you want to call it. For instance, one thing that occurred to me is early on, I had 3 days OR. This is my previous job, 1 day of clinic and a day in the lab. And when I came here, and there's some situational things, you know, the previous chief decided to pursue a opportunity in the industry, and I had to kind of increase some clinical work, but I had a couple more clinical days. And then the fallout from those clinical days, the labs, the messages, the this, the that, without having this, you know, time between cases and, you know, the patients getting prepped, it was almost like when I reflected, you know, 3 days in the ORs, there are 8 to 10 hours of downtime where I can handle whatever I need to handle. In a clinic, as we all know, you're kind of going from 8 to 5, and then you deal with the fallout, and then you do that again. And then you do that again. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is totally nutty. And so I think, you know, some of the actual specifics of your week breakdown, I think understanding what the support looks like, you know, this is a word that I've heard a lot more than previously. And Phil, you probably can empathize or at least commiserate. You don't know what you don't know, right? And you don't know what you know or you don't know until you change. So if you had like an amazing nurse that handled your in-basket and then you don't, then you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that there are different ways of doing this. Or if the patient messages come into X, Y, and Z, is it protected block time versus, say departmental block time? So these are all things that you don't really know until it's changed. So I don't know. Let me just pause there to see what your thoughts are. I'm kind of going at it.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I think they're really important points. You know, I kind of lump it down into kind of three categories I thought about during the transition, or I look back at it, I thought were important things. Well, actually, I'm going to make it four. The first was, you said, kind of giving people notice and preparing them, right? So certainly gave my patients notice. Once it was finalized, the residents, I spent a lot of time with the residents, talking with them, telling them, I sat down with the residents personally, didn't send an email. This is why I'm leaving, because you build really close relationships, especially with your trainees, with my own staff, I spent a lot of time with, just to kind of let people know. And I took, I wouldn't say an excessive amount of time, but several weeks where people knew I was leaving, but I continued to work. So, you know, we could kind of say slow goodbyes, especially at a big place like Hopkins. But importantly, to your point, I took a month off. And this came from a really good friend of mine who is actually a headhunter by trade. And when he negotiates contracts for CEOs and leadership people, he negotiates into the contract a mandatory anywhere from kind of 2 to 6 months off before they start the job. And every high-powered person says, that's way too much time. I want to get to work. And his pushback is, no, my reputation relies on you doing well in your job. So I want you well rested. I want you thinking about this. I want you ready to go. And so I didn't take 6 months off, but I took 4 weeks and I spent a lot of time with my kids. We spent a lot of time on the beach and I spent a lot of time kind of mentally preparing for the move to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So preparation was a big part of this. And I'll just plug, none of us have written this book, but the first 90 days, anybody in a job transition, really good book. I don't know if did you pick this one up, Aditya, or have you seen this one?
You know, I heard about it. I haven't read it. And yeah. I almost feel like I might cringe if I read it now, because yeah. I think the idea is to sit back and listen for the first 90 days. That may have lasted like 90 seconds for better, for worse.
Well, it's kind of active list. I mean, listen, there are some novel things that you may pick up in there, but a lot of it's kind of common sense and reaffirms a lot of the things that we do well, but it helps you kind of objectify and be kind of a thoughtful listener, I put it. But to kind of break things down from there, early wins are huge, right? Whether it's clinical or programmatic, and you know, with your leadership and with your colleagues, just small steps, not trying to hit a home run and start a whole new program that's the greatest thing that UCSD or Penn's ever seen. No, small wins. Little advances in clinic, make this a little more efficient, show everybody how much you care, I think is one thing. Second one is understand culture. Take a lot of time to understand the culture. Institutions are very different culturally. And just like you said, epic inboxes. I mean, that may be individually culturally different, right? You may have had an assistant or a nurse or a PA or somebody who worked things differently. Understanding culture, allowing people to work, and listen, you're not going to change culture. Maybe ever, but definitely not overnight. So allow them to exist in their culture and see how you can both enhance yourselves. And then the last part is exactly what you brought. You have to be prepared to make adjustments all the time. Set your plans and then be prepared to adjust. My first day of work, I had no administrative assistant. The clinic manager gave her resignation the day I walked in, not for any bad reasons, had nothing to do with me. It was a great opportunity for her. But, you know, I mean, major adjustments right away. I basically had to hire an entire new staff because COVID wiped out our entire administrative staff. No PAs, no NPs, you know, so we kind of brought in a whole new team, and that was a big adjustment. And then I've had the opposite issue clinically as you, where I'm now, we expected a little bit of a quicker ramp up, but with COVID and everything else, while I have the OR time, I'm giving it to my partners and I'm taking on more clinic time to just get more patients in the door, to see more patients, build more of a practice here, because it's not as quick building up, which is an adjustment. Now, I'm confident in my ultimate plan of where it's going to end up. So is my chair, so is my CEO, so is everybody. But we're not there yet, so we've got to make adjustments to help us get there a little quicker.
Totally, totally. And, you know, I actually really appreciated this when I was interviewing. This came from Manoj, who actually recently, I guess it's been a couple of years now, transitioned to the chair at San Diego. And he was like, listen, that the first 6 months are going to be tough. It's going to be comparisons left and right. And you'll probably second guess your decision all the time. He said the next six months. So this is, 6 to 12, there's a little bit more of a time of acceptance. And, you're starting to establish some endearment, some loyalty, some connection. And then he said, from then on, you start kind of going on to it. And I actually extended around 18 months. It's ownership. You don't really have the right to complain or gripe if you've been somewhere for 18 months and you haven't been able to kind of shape things in a way that's acceptable and enjoyable to you. Some of that's on you. So he was like, it's hard. Your kids are going to be in a new school and your wife's going to find a new job and you're not going to know where anything is and new friends. And he's like, making friends when you're 40 years old is not the same as making friends when you're 25. And all of that's kind of, true. But I really appreciated that it's not just like all roses and high fives all around from time point zero. Moves are a pain, move is actually brutal. But I absolutely can kind of see it real time, having heard it and it clearly stuck with me. To see that, first I'm like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. And it's just so different. And I remember how we used to do like this, there's some of that nostalgism where everything used to, now. I mean, I couldn't tell you one bad thing about UT Southwestern now, not because it doesn't exist, but it just gets erased. It's like childbirth, I guess, it's just like, you look back and you're like, oh my God, it was amazing. But I can kind of see it happening real time where now, I know the residents and we've got a rapport and I don't have to be quite as super formal with everybody. And, and the fellows where, some of the research stuff starting to pick up, some cool ideas are taking off and, it's happening again. And, it's not like, oh, I just left all of this perfect previous job. It's like, all right, yeah, now I'm starting to kind of have an effect and understand, what the tremendous amount of resources are over here. Those are just kind of global things that I've picked up on the last, 5 months.
Yeah, I love that. And like I said, I'm a little behind you. So I'm starting, my IRBs are just getting through. We're just starting to get the research up. So we're starting to get excited about the projects, enrolling patients and kind of doing those things. So yeah, I think I'm lagging a little behind you, but we'll catch up eventually. Hopefully 18, 24 months, we're both in really happy places. But you brought up the friends and family transition. How are you, tell us, things that are working for you that didn't work for you. I'm smack in the middle of the transition and will be for some time. So it's, slightly different stories, but tell us about your friends and family transition, stuff outside of the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so my kids are 5 and 8. And circumstantially, I think like everybody, a year and a half of pandemic, end of the summer. So it wasn't like we were ultra social, physically with other people as much as, previously. So that helped. But, in the same breath, like not having like somebody to call up and have a beer with on like a weekend night or knowing many people is totally bizarre. And, the professional friends, the staff and, our personal friends outside of work, that was obviously like a very, very hard thing to leave. And, it's happening here. Slowly but surely. I think like so many things in life, you want to be a little bit more selective. I don't want to spend time with somebody unless I'm really excited about spending time with them. You're hanging out at a kid's soccer game or who knows what, pick up, drop off, and you meet somebody and they seem like an interesting, cool couple, and you get together and, you know, between limited discretionary downtime and now I feel super fortunate to have so much family around. You know, I've seen parents, in-laws, siblings more in the last 5 months than I probably have the previous 5 years combined. And that's amazing. You know, it's absolutely amazing. So, it's hard leaving old friends behind these days. It's easy. You know, yesterday I was watching the Titans game, AFC South, number one seed. And one of my buddies just kind of hit a FaceTime and we just kind of caught up, and, you know, it's easy these days. But it's, you know, a move is also another opportunity, I think, to really just rely on your family to, you know, spend that time to be like, this is our starting nuclear unit that we're going to focus on, make sure everybody's okay in this transition, and, you know, broaden it out again, recognizing it takes time to make meaningful friends.
Yeah. It's great advice and great kind of thought process there. You know, ours slightly different. You know, my family is still in Baltimore. And like I said, it's only about an hour and a half away. And so I come up here midweek, and every weekend I head back, except when I'm on call. And, you know, for 2 weeks, that was amazing. You know, no wife, no kids, new job, totally excited about things. Hours were kind of mine. And then you very quickly got very lonely. And it can be really challenging during the week, to be honest with you. And the call weeks, especially when you're up here on the weekend and, you know, especially during the pandemic, I don't drag the kids around the Philadelphia city. I let them kind of sit at home in Baltimore, and that can be a challenge. But remember that it's finite. It's got a short window to it in the scheme of things. And we decided, the reason we did that is because we decided we only wanted to move the kids' schools once. And we wanted to have as little disruption on their lives as possible, given all the craziness that they've been through in the last, like you said, 2 years with the pandemic. And my kids are almost exactly the same age. My little one's 5, my older one's 7, will be 8 this summer. So they will start a brand new school together. We now know where we're going to be. And one of the things we consciously did is in Baltimore, we're kind of, our neighborhood's not so social, to be honest with you, but it's a great house, great property. We're very comfortable where we are. And we can see all of our friends pretty easily, easy access to our friends. But we decided to buy into a much more social neighborhood to help facilitate new relationships for the kids, new relationships for us with people in the area, to try and be a little more communal, recognizing that we're entering an area where we don't, you know, other than people at work, we really don't have any established contacts in the Philly area. So slightly different.
Totally. Yeah. It is a weird feeling to be like, I don't have a lot of friends over here, but taking it in stride, you know, it'll happen. There's people that kind of bubble up, and you know, I've certainly hit it off with several of my partners and the fellows and residents. So yeah, I think just like most things, be patient and be selective. You know, it's not like you're 20 years old trying to be the most popular person at college. I want to have some, you know, substantial friends.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, we're getting towards the end of kind of the hour here. So, you know, we'll finish on kind of advice, you know, to people thinking about making a transition. You know, well, we can both kind of summarize and say what we've learned or what advice you'd give out.
Yeah, I think try to enjoy the process. You know, I was super stressed out for no reason. I don't know why I was stressed out. I think it was just like all the unknowns and, but maybe especially if somebody's reached out to you or showed interest when you've reached out, just be like, yeah, this is, you know, I've done something that's put me on somebody's radar. I encourage open communication with your existing institution sooner rather than later. I thought it was hilarious. One day, and this, you've kind of got to know Klaus to really appreciate this. He's like, well, Aditya, I received a letter from Kelly Parsons for a reference. I was like, well, yeah, Klaus, I put you as a reference. You know, I'm not trying to hide anything. And we talked about this, remember? So I think that's totally valuable. You know, the actual mechanics of a new job, the negotiation, what your week looks like, support, supplies, all that. That's, you know, that's outside of the scope of this particular podcast, I think. But remember, maybe that first 6 months is going to be, you know, a bit of a comparative phase. the next 6 months, you may start kind of getting endeared to your new gigs and settling in. And then, you know, hopefully over the course of that first year and a half or so, it becomes your institution all over again, that you can start to really impact and hopefully make, you know, make it something that resembles a place that you want to be.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I've jotted down some notes as we've talked, and just to kind of pull some of those up to help kind of summarize here. You know, I think one of the first things to think about if you're thinking about a transition, is this a pull transition or a push transition? Kind of, as you said before, right? Is this something really exciting coming from another institution, which is, you know, the good fortune that you and I both had, or is this a push? And there are people who are going to be in push situations where they're really just unhappy with where they are. It's not meeting their expectations or their career identity or their purpose or who they want to be or what they want to be. And that's okay too. And just be thoughtful about that. Is it a push or is it a pull? Because it gives you different, you want to approach each differently, I would think. And, you know, your intentions and your thoughts about the transition would be different depending on your situation. I jotted notes about, I think, some really nice things you said. Be patient, right? Especially at the beginning. Be intentional, be thoughtful with your process. And then I think both of us have kind of alluded to this, is a positive perspective can go a long way. You're going to hit roadblocks. You're going to need to make adjustments. It's not all going to be roses and sugar plums. I don't even know what the right analogy is. But, you know, it's not all going to be happiness every day of the week. And listen, I could have got really upset. Well, the clinic manager left. They're not providing enough support. What am I doing here? No, this is an opportunity for me to build from scratch, right? And so it's just flipping that perspective. We can't control our current situation, but we can control the way we view it and the way we interact with it, right? And so in the operating room, I use an Omni for my RPLNDs and nephrectomies. They don't have an RPLND. I mean, they don't have an Omni in this hospital. And guess what? We got some free sets for trial from some reps, and now we're putting together the Omni I want for exactly the cases I want. So it could have been something to get really annoyed at and be upset for the first few cases using a retractor you don't want to use. But then it turns into a great opportunity to build out the program and build out the surgeries the way you want to do it. So stay positive. It's going to have its ups and downs.
Yeah, I'll just piggyback one final thought on that, Phil. This is actually something I picked up from a Art of Living course my wife and I did last summer. And the advice was not to assign intention to actions. And it's going to be the little things, right, that kind of get under your skin, that may be a little bit annoying, that something is getting done or not done. And just remember, that's not a person intentionally doing something directed at you. It's like, if you get cut off, the guy's not, or the girl's not cutting you off because of you. They just did something. Lord knows what's going on in their life. And our reaction is going to be what kind of dictates how that affects us. And it can be these small things. And if you're like, the clinic manager left and somehow that was directed towards me, that's clearly ludicrous. But if they don't have an Omni that's directed towards me, of course that's ludicrous. And it's more what I need to communicate, right? To say, these are my expectations. These are what I want, because things that are suboptimal are not happening because they're directed towards me. They're just happening. And unless anybody knows that you want it to happen in a different way, they don't have any sixth sense to be like, oh yeah, the fact that X, Y, and Z doesn't happen is annoying or frustrating or inefficient, or there's a better way.
Yeah. And I'll piggyback off your piggyback. It's not only the communication, but be kind about it, right? You're a new person at a new place. You want people to know you as the new nice surgeon, right? And that goes a long way, is just open communication. Be kind, let people understand that you're willing to work with them in good, bad, or indifferent. And it'll, I think, go a long way. And we've seen people shoot themselves in the foot, you know, starting at the same institution they may have trained at, going on to a new institution, starting off with a bad attitude or, you know, bad relationships. And that can really linger and ruin kind of, or not ruin, but it can take a long time to recover from those things.
Absolutely, Phil.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as always, time spent with you is good use of time. Learned a lot. Always appreciate your perspective, and you know, congrats again on what you've been able to do to maybe bring some of the non-medical, non-urology parts of life to the forefront in a safe space.
Well, thanks, man. And I really appreciate you being a part of it and sharing with everybody your story and going back and forth with me today.
Well, good. All right, bud.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Operate with Zen, and we'll talk to you again soon.